You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And our guest on this hour is Whitney Hardy. Welcome, Whitney.
Hi, thank you.
It's good to have you with us this morning.
It's good to be here.
So, Whitney, just tell me a little bit about yourself, a thumbnail sketch, before we start this conversation and before we go to the music. What do we need to know to start our time to this morning?
Well, you need to know that I grew up in California and Texas, both mm-hmm. places. Come from a fairly colorful / dysfunctional family, and I think that's had a lot to do with who I am now. Mm-hmm. I studied photography at Brigham Young University, which is where I met my husband in Utah. Mm-hmm. And now I raise two daughters. They are beautiful and challenging and very smart, fun to be around. Mm-hmm, and I just kind of go back and forth between being intensely curious about things and overwhelmingly exhausted.
So. And depending upon the age of your kids, I can imagine that that's also part of the space of life right now.
Right.
As well as a style of living.
Right. They are 2 and 4. So sometimes I think there will be time to read later or...
Yeah. Well, you brought some music with you today, and we're gonna start with the first one, which is a tune written by Willie Nelson, but performed most memorably, I believe, by Patsy Cline, and it's called Crazy. And let me just get this queued up and ready.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I let wondering what in the world did I do? Oh, crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying, and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. Crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying, and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
That was Patsy Cline singing Crazy, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Whitney Hardy. Whitney, tell me about that song. Where does that song come from in your life?
Well, it has a really special place in my life. Aside from songs like Itsy Bitsy Spider and Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, it was the first song that I learned all the lyrics to. So
your first adult song.
Yes, my first grown-up song.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in my bedroom with a cassette of my mother singing this song. She had recorded it in one of those amusement park recording studios.
Yeah.
And so that was who I thought originally sang the song was, my mother. She sounded a lot like Patsy Cline also. And I just would listen to it over and over again and memorize little bits at a time until I could sing the whole thing. And that really, you know, I was probably 5 or 6, and that really got me interested in singing kind of, you know, led to later in high school, I was known to shut myself in my bedroom with a cassette recorder, and there are tapes of me saying, "Oh, say, can you see," over and over again,
interspersed
with, like, "Get out of my room," from when my siblings would come in.
Yeah. So you grew up making music.
Yeah. In a way, I don't play any instruments, just singing.
Just sing. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a musical family, in that we sang conversation even. That was kind of when we were working on the farm. That's kind of what we were working, cleaning the house or in the yard or whatever. Or just to make things light when they were kind of down, we would sing. And we also sang on trips together a lot.
Yeah, we were big car singers.
Yeah.
And I was a real stickler for lyrics, so... Just like with Crazy, I would listen to songs over and over till I knew every lyric. And if anyone flubbed a word, I was the first one to say, "Nope, it doesn't go that way."
You were the fundamentalist singer. That's funny. That's funny. Well, this is going to be a kind of intense conversation because you've got a really powerful story. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about something that's a little lighter and comes out of the lighter side of your singing. You are part of a musical group at the LDS Church here, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or otherwise commonly known as the Mormons. I know that's not a popular...
Right. Well, it goes back and forth.
Yeah. It's just how do we refer to each other, and what are the names, and what do people recognize? And so you're part of a singing group called the Taffetas, and that's for the show, or is that your group? Is that the group's name? Or
no, it's the show.
It's the show. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so tell us about what the group does, and tell us a bit about what the show is.
Okay, so the group was formed really for the show.
Uh-huh,
we just
uh-huh.
came together as a result of casting and auditions, and the show is a 4-woman show. And it's about 4 sisters from Muncie, Indiana, who are making their national television debut. And it takes place in the 50s. So their real goal is to make it to the Ed Sullivan Show, big times.
So they're kind of working their way up the talent show circuit.
Right. So this is their first time on television, and they're just really sweet girls from down home Muncie. And they grew up singing a lot of the popular music of the day. So,
and that's what they're performing.
Right. So it's mostly a musical. It's a musical review with a little bit of dialogue in between.
Mm-hmm.
And we sing a lot of songs like Mr. Sandman and Lollipop and Johnny Angel.
Right. The 50s standards. The mid-50s mid to late 50s standards.
Definitely. Yeah. And then there's some pop culture references that those of us... We're all fairly young in the cast. Some of them we've had to Google because I don't know who Connie and girls are.
So this and this is for performances that are going to take place at the LDS Church building on Burley Drive,
right?
And that's going to happen April 25th and 26th.
Yeah, that's right. We have evening performances on the 25th and 26th. It's a Friday and Saturday.
Right.
And then there's also a matinee on Saturday.
Right. And how can people kind of find out about how to get tickets to that? How can people find out how to attend that? It's a fundraiser for Feed My Starving Children and the Ithaca Mobile Pack. Is that at ithacamobilepack.org?
Yes.
Yes.
That would be the best place to go.
Right.
If you go under fundraising events, there's a separate website for the show specifically.
Right.
But it's easiest to access through fundraising events.
And you go and find out about the show, and then you find out a little bit why this came together, why you guys committed to making this event happen.
Right. Yeah. We're just trying to raise money for Ithaca Mobile Pack, and it's going to be a dinner theater, so there will be... a curry dinner to go along with the show. It should be really fun.
Yeah, good. Well, in keeping with that show, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a cut from the McGuire Sisters, Sincerely. And is this one of the songs?
We do sing this. It's one of our very favorites.
Okay. Sincerely, the McGuire Sisters.
'cause I love you so dearly.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and that was the McGuire sisters singing Sincerely, and that's a little bit of a preview of some of the music from the 1950s that's going to be happening at an event to support the Ithaca Mobile Pack and Feed My Starving Children efforts here in Ithaca, and that's going to happen on April 25th and 26th, and if you want to know more about that, you can go to IthacaMobilePack.org on the web and find out about the event and about the Ithaca Mobile Pack. Our guest this hour is Whitney Hardy. So, Whitney, what brought you to Ithaca?
That's pretty straightforward, actually. Mm-hmm. My husband goes to school at Cornell. Mm-hmm. He's getting his master's in the ILR program.
Okay.
So we came here knowing it would just be a two-year time period.
Right. And this is, are you in your second year?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. So you're about ready to take off.
Mm-hmm. We'll be leaving the end of May, actually, to move to Seattle for a job.
Okay. Okay. And so he's already got a job in hand and ready to go?
Yep. We're pretty much packing our bags, saying okay. Goodbye to Ithaca.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So we're getting you as you're heading out the door. And just, you had said, you kind of gave us a very quick sketch. You grew up in California, Texas, also that you're a photographer, and
mm-hmm.
and what kind of photography do you do?
You know, I mostly do birth photography, which I've had people misunderstand me before and say bird photography,
right,
but it's
right.
Women giving birth,
mm-hmm.
labor and delivery that's kind of my specialty.
Right.
And outside of that, I also do family photographs.
Right. Now, do you do these primarily in home birth settings or
I do.
In hospital or birthing center settings?
I've done all, but mm-hmm. Home birth seems to be the most popular.
Right.
Something about the home birth. I think families that choose home birth are often looking to document that experience.
Right.
Sometimes more often than families that choose to birth in the hospital.
Right, right, right. Or in my situation, really, home birth was not an option in Missouri when my kids were my oldest daughter was born. But we do have have pictures as well as audio tapes of their first sounds, which was really important
oh, wow.
to me, was to get their very first sounds.
That's
yeah.
neat.
Yeah. So tell me about growing up. What made your family colorful / dysfunctional? What was the?
Well, I'm the oldest of four children, mm-hmm. and my mother had me when she was 16. Right. So I think
so she was really young.
She was really young, yeah. And my father was a bit older. He was 27, and I think the dysfunction probably started long before I arrived on the scene. Mm-hmm. And so my younger brother was born a year and a half after I was, and my parents were divorced when I was 3, and that's when my mom moved out to Texas, and my dad stayed in California, so that's where I get the back and forth.
Oh, I see.
Childhood, growing up in both places. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My mother had a lot of difficulties. Growing up, I was aware that she was an alcoholic and that she had some mental illnesses that she struggled with. Mm-hmm. It was really hard for her to get a good diagnosis, but usually it was called depression or bipolar disorder, and her last diagnosis was borderline personality disorder.
And those are all extremely common diagnoses,
yeah.
And hard to kind of, yeah.
So that,
what did that make for your childhood? What was it like growing up in two different places and with one person? Was your father more capable or functional? Or
he was, but he never really had custody of us for any long period of time.
Right.
So
right.
I saw him in the summers, but from a really young age, I felt very close to my mother. You mm-hmm. know, kind of this too close, maybe this enmeshed kind of relationship
where
I took care of her from a very young age, and that fostered a lot of codependence in our relationship.
Yep,
so
yep. You took care of her, or you tried to take care of her.
Yeah, so there was a certain amount of loyalty there. Mm-hmm. So growing up, I felt very extremely close to my mother, mm-hmm. very loyal. I felt it really important to protect her from things, and it wasn't until I got older, around teenage years, that I started to feel like this isn't really my job, or this isn't
right.
really what I want to be doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But before that point, there was just a series of, she had a few husbands and we moved constantly. I think I lived in 30 houses before I graduated high school. And
wow.
I used the word house in a very liberal sense because they were rarely actual houses. They were usually trailers or apartments, or we lived mm-hmm. in a number of different mm-hmm. settings.
They were a place where you could sleep and hopefully safely.
Yeah. So growing up was really, instability was a good word to describe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it was terrible all the time. There were some times that we were really happy, but mm-hmm. there were a lot of times that my mom would pack us into the car in the middle of the night and say, I'm leaving this man, and we're starting again. And there was a lot of times where I was never hungry, but I was aware that food was hard to come by.
And right, it was an issue.
Yeah, so there were just a lot of struggles and a lot of emotional turmoil.
When you heard her say that it was time to leave, how did you feel about that? What was that like to hear that?
Yeah, I
repeatedly?
Think as a child, it's always scary to have anything interrupted or disrupted. But at the same time, my life was such a series of disruptions that it almost felt expected.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, I could kind of see the writing on the wall. This marriage wasn't going so well. Maybe now we'll be happier, or maybe mom will get it together this time.
Right. So you have not only one younger sibling with your biological father, you have two other younger siblings.
Right, two other younger siblings. Mm-hmm. I'm not as close with them.
Mm-hmm.
They are from some subsequent marriages of
right.
my mother's. And
mm-hmm.
my youngest sister is 10 years younger than me, so
mm-hmm.
I kind of took care of her too growing up,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
it was...
And now, and you have two children of your own.
Now I have two children.
Right. So what have you? Well, first let's. I'm going to want to pick up with what have you learned from this, but I also want to know what happened with your mom.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to separate because it all sort of happened at the same time. You
mm-hmm.
know, learning how to separate from my mother and how to have some semblance of a relationship without being involved in her.
Mm-hmm.
in her daily...
To have to assert some of the boundaries that she couldn't give you.
Right. Yeah. So that, when I graduated high school, I left Texas and went to school in Utah. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a big separating moment.
And how did you pick Brigham Young? I mean, do you come from a Mormon background? Or?
You know, I actually joined the church when I was 14. Mm-hmm. Another part of our instability growing up was that my family could not stick with a religion. So we went everywhere. I was Lutheran for a time. We were Unitarian at one point. I attended a Pentecostal church, mm-hmm. and one of my stepfathers was Catholic. So there was a lot of flux in our religious identities.
So in a sense, what made Mormonism stick for you, at least enough to go to college there?
Yeah, well... At the age of 14, my mom had been praying for a miracle because her life was in shambles again, and the Mormon missionaries knocked on the door. And she opened the door and she said, "No, not Mormons." And she shut the door and went back to praying. And so that's kind of a fun little story about how she realized that maybe this was the answer to her prayers. And she chased them down the street, and so we started taking lessons with them. And I just had some really strong spiritual impressions when we were meeting with them that that this was a religion that answered many of the questions that I had had growing up.
Such as?
Such as, what happens after we die? You know, where do we go? And I had a really hard time with so many churches. I felt like they said, if you don't belong to our church, you don't go to heaven. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like, that can't be true. That can't be the kind of God that I believe in. Mm-hmm. And Mormons have a doctrine that some people are aware of called baptisms for the dead. And mm-hmm. so the Mormons say, you know, we do believe that we have the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but if you don't join with us in this life, you have the opportunity to join later. Mm-hmm. Or so mm-hmm. to me, that felt very... it just felt a little closer to what I had been looking for, mm-hmm. a little more,
not so
more about acceptance. Yeah, a lot more about and we can all make it.
Right. And people react to that as a bit of forced inclusion, and that's the downside of that belief. But the upside of it is that it really welcomes.
Right, and I've faced kind of the other side of that as I grew mm-hmm. later. So. Mm-hmm. I have my own questions about Mormonism. I call myself now kind of a questioning Latter-day Saint. Mm-hmm. And I still attend and I still practice a lot of my religious tradition, mm-hmm. but not without questions.
Right. Okay, so that was a digression that I took us off on.
Yeah, we digressed.
Yeah, well, this show is one ongoing digression.
So I joined the church when I was 14, mm-hmm. and that became a huge part of my identity. And so when it came time to go to college, Brigham Young University was just where I knew I wanted to go mm-hmm. to have, I think, to partially to escape my family and also to be able to get a good education that was affordable.
Right. And then that's where you discovered photography. And what happened with respect to the separation from your mom? Because when you leave that kind of a situation, it's a dramatic leaving. And
yeah.
I had many friends from my growing up where that kind of a separation was almost a deal breaker in their lives.
Right. Yeah. So my mother always encouraged my academic pursuits. I did very well in school, and she was always so proud of me. And then as I got closer to graduating, she started saying things about community college and maybe you should stick closer to home. Mm-hmm. And by that point, I was just done. And I said, mm-hmm. no, I'm going. And it did mark a big downturn in her life. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it has felt like I chose my own life. Mm-hmm. I chose to go leave a situation that wasn't good and start something for myself mm-hmm. at the age of 17, and she was sort of lost. So much of her identity,
was
wrapped up with us.
At that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and she, that was her life, was she raised us and we brought, our accomplishments brought her joy. She didn't have mm-hmm. much of her own identity. So mm-hmm. there was, after I left home, her third marriage fell apart and the family kind of dispersed. My brother went to live with my father and the two younger siblings stayed with their father, and it we just were never really as close after that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in a sense you were her teammate.
Yeah.
And it's hard. That's a hard choice to make.
Right. I took a lot of that for a long time. And I'm still kind of dealing with that, feeling like, you know, it's not my fault what happened in the years that followed. But it can be a hard truth to accept.
Right. So you picked another song. Do you want to introduce this next song?
Yeah, I'll introduce it. So after college, after I got married and I already had my first daughter.
So this is 4 years ago or?
It happened two years ago. Yeah. My second daughter was 3 months old. Uh-huh. And my mom had been going downhill for a number of months and years even. And one night I got a call that she had died of an overdose in a hotel room in Wisconsin. And it was something that I always knew was a possibility, and I was always preparing myself for that because she had attempted to take her life a number of times. But it's something that, while not surprising, is just ever so shocking.
Right.
So this song, my brother, my husband, and my children, we all flew out to Wisconsin to deal with her body and what was left of her items, belongings. And my brother met us there. He was still in his undergraduate degree at BYU. And it was one of the hardest moments of my life to see her body, to say goodbye, to try to sort all of this out in my mind, knowing that she had taken her own life, committed suicide. Right. And when we were sitting in the back of the car, my brother put his headphones over my ears and played this song for me. And it's called Welcome Home, Son.
And we're going to play that now.
Oh,
And that was Radical Face and Welcome Home, Son. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Whitney Hardy. And Whitney, so this was the song that was that you listened to after your mother's suicide.
Yeah, and it really, you know, on the one-year anniversary of her death, I played this song, and I just, it just really brought, it always brings me back to that time. The words just seemed so fitting for what I was going through. The lyric that says, sleep, don't visit, and choking on the sun. Those days immediately following her death were just such a blur of painful emotion.
Right. Right. So, and you had said she had made attempts before or talked before?
Yeah, she had made a number of attempts. Yeah.
And that still doesn't change the reality of it.
No, it doesn't.
No, no, so. Being the oldest child from her firstborn, that is the that experience and her death have really shaped your life.
They have.
But how have you come out of it? How have you changed?
Oh, well, I feel like I'm still coming out of it. You know, it only happened 2 years
right,
ago.
Right, no, you are, like, and you said when we were off air, you were saying it's like, I feel like I'm very young and I'm also very old.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. So in the immediate days after her death, I felt like everything had meaning. You know, everywhere I looked, I saw goodness and love and beauty, and I was just so aware of all that was good in life. And then depression started to set in in the months following her death. And what I really experienced at that time was unlike anything before. I'd been through a lot of turmoil, but suddenly it was like someone pulled the floor out from underneath me, everything was up for grabs. So it was just a real period of questioning. And I think that's kind of still where I am in a lot of places. Taking the time now to look back and think about my relationship with my mother and how my childhood formed who I am today and where I want to go from here.
Right. And how has this impacted your marriage, your kids?
It has had a huge impact on my marriage. You know, luckily, my husband and I had a very strong marriage to begin with, and so he has done everything that he can to support me, and but it has been hard, you know. They're just this. We've said to each other, "This isn't what we signed up for when we got married." You know, I was 21 and he was 22, and we knew there would be hard times, but we didn't know they would come so soon. Would be so drastic. So, I would say it's bringing us closer together in the long term, but it also just is painfully terrible in the short run.
Right. No, I hear you. I also just you made it out, but even having made it out, you still have the echoes of it carrying it with you, and when something like this happens, you're right back where you were.
Yeah, I feel like you're never really out. Like your past, I made a choice very young not to become my mother, not to repeat her mistakes, and yet the life that we live together still impacts my life daily. And, you know, you asked about my children. I am always wondering, I'm always trying to walk that balance between how do I have a life of my own and an identity of my own like my mother didn't, and how do I still give them what they need like my mother didn't.
Right.
For me.
Right, so. Right. And how can you learn what it is that they need when you didn't get exposed to getting it?
Yeah.
Or in tangential ways or in, you know, indirect ways.
So sometimes I wonder, do all mothers sit around wondering about this all the time, or do some people just follow the pattern of their parents? And
I think we have such a cult of parenthood here that most people worry and fear probably more than they need to. Those of us who've had really, my mother was very depressed for most of the years. I mean, I was born as a replacement baby for one who died because her depression was so intense. And that was something that I've had to kind of come to terms with. Who am I? Am I who I am, or am I somebody else? You know. And so I think I understand some of the issues in around separating and leaving and
these
feeling
questions,
responsible.
These questions of identity are one of the reasons I was excited to come on the show, and also a little nervous, was because all I've been doing for the last 2 years is kind of questioning my identity.
Right.
Where do I belong now that she's gone? What does that make of me?
it makes you you.
Yeah.
and we're gonna cut to Tracy Chapman now and a song called Change, and I think that and then I want to begin to spend a little bit of time talking about what you do practically on a daily basis to sustain yourself.
Great.
And I think, you know, we have many things to learn from your experience.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low you cannot fall, would you change? Would you change? How bad, how good does it need to get? How many losses, how much regret? What chain reaction would cause an effect? Makes you turn around, makes you try to explain, makes you forgive and forget, makes you change. Change.
That was Tracy Chapman, and if you knew you were going to die today and you saw the face of God and love, would you change? And how, you know, that you picked that song because it's been a monumental song in the period since your mother died,
mm-hmm.
Since her suicide. What do you do to sustain yourself, to kind of hold a modicum of sense of stability, but also to change, because this is an enormous change.
Yeah, well, the biggest thing I do is I go to therapy twice a week.
Right.
And I just do, in practical ways, I'm learning to try to give myself space to discover who I am, mm-hmm. and to be more accepting of myself and my feelings, and that's something I didn't really grow up with, the ability to express any emotion at any time. My mother was so fragile that...
You had to maintain yourself in order so you could take care of...
Yeah, I had to shove it down and mm-hmm. be the strong one. And so it's just a learning process. I honestly read probably too many self-help books, and
right.
I kind of am just puzzling over these ideas a lot mm-hmm. in my life. And then I also try to get enough sleep, spend quality time with my mm-hmm. husband and our kids, and sometimes I write,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes I find distractions like the Taffeta show. Or
right, but just from what I know about what singing does to your body, and when you sing for 7 to 10 minutes, it's the same as deep meditation or breathing for 7 to 10 minutes. It has a way of releasing endorphins and helping your body to cope.
Yeah.
And so that is a very powerful discipline for helping, sustain you.
I've been a bit of an endorphin junkie. I started training for the Try at the Y. Mm-hmm, and I think in a lot of different ways I'm looking for just what can I do and what... trying to have new experiences, trying to reinvent myself in
right,
some ways.
Right. This may be a little off base, but maybe it's a story you'll understand. In my family of origin, I was the sixth of seven kids. We had a two-bedroom house, and there were four sisters who shared a bedroom. My parents mm-hmm. shared a bedroom, and my younger brother slept in a crib there. I slept on the couch or in the pantry if I didn't want to be in too much noise, and my older brother slept on the back porch year-round. So, but there was never really any bedtime ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I discovered late in life was that I didn't know how to wind down at the end of the day. So I would just work, and then I would collapse and go to sleep. I read to my kids. I knew that's what I needed to do when they were growing up and was part of that. But I worked way too much until I collapsed. And only, you know, relatively recently in life have I learned I can have a cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make this the end of the day, and this is the time when I settle down, and I'm finally in a relationship where we walk each other down at the end of the day. And those kinds of self-care are things that we often didn't learn. Those of us who've been in kind of dysfunctional families or families that were chaotic for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
you don't learn.
Mm-hmm.
What have you had to learn as a parent and as a self-care, in your own self-care?
Oh, so I've had to learn so much about self-care. So mm-hmm. I've had to learn to not apologize after asking for something,
mm-hmm.
to not start something by saying, I'm sorry, but I need time for myself. But to just learn to say, I could really use some time to myself and mm-hmm. not feel guilty about that. That's been a huge thing, especially with two small children.
Right. And so... I sense just from your saying that you've been able to do it. You don't feel fully good about it, but but it's happening.
It's happening. A lot of them, it's the same thing. I'm trying to learn how to say no and when to say no. That's mm-hmm. another mm-hmm. big part of mm-hmm. self-care for me. And that's one I think learning comes in stages. So I'm at the stage where I recognize there's a problem, but I have yet to figure out how to solve it. So I tend to overcommit myself mm-hmm. and... mm-hmm. I think a lot of people do that.
Right. And I think there are some gender differences. I think as a man coming out of that experience, I tended to, my first reaction to things was critical and negative oftentimes, and that was in effect saying no, that I had to learn how to be positive to things rather than to be so touchy mm. and reactive, and I think that's more stereotypically male. So I've had to learn how to say yes, but how to say yes in ways that respect the self-care time that I need.
Yeah. I'm just starting to learn about boundaries, including mm-hmm. where, I'm still piecing together where my mother ended and where I began. And mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. where do I end and where do my daughters begin? And
right.
what can I have that's just for myself?
Right. And there are people who would challenge even your sharing this on the show because they would see that as questionable about boundaries.
Oh, yes.
But I... this is something that's important, and if we cannot talk about it, we create a secret place that is more terrifying than if we talk openly about it. And many of us have had experiences of parents or friends who have suicided, and our lives have had to be pieced back together. They were contorted by their own mental health issues when they were alive, and we need to talk about the journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still trying to learn. I mean, I thought about that before even coming on
sure.
the show, because growing up with no boundaries, I myself have been a chronic oversharer.
Right.
But I'm just learning to say to myself, if I feel comfortable saying it out loud, it's all right. It's my truth.
Right. And it's also, it doesn't imply that people, you know, people can listen to it or not listen to it. And they can question what you've said or they can challenge it, but it is your truth.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that we don't have many honest conversations in public about really awkward things. And a lot of our absence of boundaries has more to do with our disrespect for the self-determination of the people in our lives rather than what we know about them.
Mm.
You know, we confuse in this culture the issue of privacy, which is secrecy to some extent, with the issue of self-determination. Kids oftentimes can deal with parents who are living through all sorts of crises if those kids have a sense that they have choices of their own to make,
mm-hmm.
like the one that you made as a 14-year-old or as a 17-year-old to go to Brigham Young. When you have a choice that you can hang your hat on and stay by it and you go up and down with it, that is making your own life. And you can know about all the messes in the world as long as you have space to make your own choices.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, I see you trying to make that kind of thing happen for your kids by taking care of yourself and not imposing on them the way you were imposed
right.
upon.
Trying not to pass on the crazy, as we call it.
Right.
Not
right.
to be politically completely incorrect.
Right. No. I know. But it's also to recognize the genuine love that you had for your mother. And also the terrible pain that she's caused you.
Yeah.
Is adulthood.
I feel like holding conflicting truths in my heart is kind of what I'm learning to do.
Mm-hmm. And it will make you wise before your years. And that's that also is a sad and painful truth. So you picked another song that we're going to close with today. And it's a Cat Stevens song. Do you want to say something about it?
Yeah, well, this is like kind of my more optimistic side showing through.
Mm-hmm.
I spent summers with my dad, and this song reminds me of driving through Northern California where the sequoias run right into the ocean.
Yeah.
The song would be playing, and the sunlight would be filtering through the trees. And it just, to me, the song speaks so much about truth and hope and joy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's just, to me, it's a simple and beautiful song.
Okay, and this is Morning Has Broken, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report has been Whitney Hardy. Whitney, it has been really, really good to get to know you.
Thank you for having me.
Broken like the first morning, blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the world. The rain's new fall, sunlit from heaven, like the first dew fall on the first grass. Praise for the sweetness of the wet garden.
bara sprung in completeness where his feet pass. Mine is the sunlight, mine is the morning, born of the one light, Eden saw play. Praise with elation, praise every morning, God's recreation of the new day. Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the world.
And that was Cat Stevens and Morning Has Broken, and our guest in this past hour of the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives, was Whitney Hardy.